Welcome to Boing Boing's Get Illuminated podcast, episode number 4, for December 6th, 2006. Today I'm speaking with Stephen Levy. He's the author of a new book called The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. Stephen is the author of one of my favorite books, Hackers, and a couple of other excellent books too, Insanely Great, which was the story of the Macintosh, and another one called Artificial Life. I started out by asking Stephen why he wrote a book about the iPod.
Well, it's funny. It's almost like, you know, the subject was waiting in form for me out in front of me. I'd done a book about the Macintosh a number of years ago, followed the Apple, followed the iPods as it came out. And in the summer of 2004, I think, I did a cover story for Newsweek about it, and focusing not so much on the technology, but the way it had become a cultural phenomenon. And it's interesting to look back. At that point, there had only been 3 million iPods sold, and, you know, it really began to take off just about then, and, you know, now it's over 70 million. You could see that it culturally was having an impact. So I decided to explore that. And after that, you know, people kept asking me, when are you going to write the book about the iPod after that cover? And finally I said, well, I guess I will. And, you know, I talked to publishers and got it going. And sure enough, the book does concentrate a lot more on the sociology and the culture of it than some of the other books I've written.
How does the iPod reflect the way people approach digital media?
Well, I think it came along just at the time where, you know, in music in particular, and now in video and movies and things like that, the digital medium became very accessible. The prices of, you know, moving the bits around to do music and, you know, to do video, you know, that came within range, and the storage and all these other things came together, so the iPod could have this big effect on people. And it really does change the way, first of all, you listen to music, you know, pretty dramatically. When you have the whole music collection out there in your pocket, you have to figure out how to listen to it, and people figure out new ways to listen to it. And when we're all connected on the internet and able to share our music preferences, it's a different process to hear about new music.
Why is it that no one can make an MP3 player that comes close to the iPod in terms of ease of use and functionality?
Well, when Apple first started, the reason why the iPod, you know, exists, the reason why Apple got into the game was because they were very unhappy with the existing devices that played music, the MP3 players. You know, Apple wanted to do a series of applications for the Macintosh to promote the Macintosh, and they did a movie one, and the camcorders were perfectly good to work with that. Then they did music, and they were very unhappy with the music devices and said, well, we'll do one of our own, and because we could do it better. It just happened to fit Apple's strengths in software and interface that they could do this kind of thing. So that really played into their sweet spot. But the way they did it was something that other places found it really hard to compete against, because the iPod isn't just a piece of hardware. It's really a satellite of this software, which lives, you know, first on a Macintosh, now on any kind of computer. So, and then when they added the store, you had this three-part system that all worked together there, and that was very hard for anyone else to come up with. Some people might have come up with cool-looking MP3 players. They didn't have the software to go with it. So everything works really, really well with the iPod. Plus, no one really competed in design with Apple. Apple really is far ahead of everyone else in that. So it had that look when you carry it around to just put that extra something to it.
It's interesting, you know, the other companies' iPods aren't any cheaper, and they're still not as good as iPods. It makes you wonder why they're even trying.
Well, you know, they try because it's a lucrative market, and it's one that's growing. And, you know, I'm actually a little surprised that Sony hasn't done more to compete. Sony sort of shot itself in the foot a couple times in China, come up with something similar. We can talk about that a little later. But Microsoft, of course, has a couple tries, and now they've got Zune, which is, you know, very consciously trying to copy that three-part, you know, system of the iPod that I talked about earlier. And, you know, right now the Zune, I don't think, is a terrific competition. It's not terrific competition for the iPod, but if Microsoft keeps working at it, maybe, you know, just like they eventually were able to compete with the Macintosh with Windows, they might be able to get a foothold.
Have you had a chance to try the Zune yet?
Yeah, I have. You know, and I mean, it's credible. I'm not wild about design. It feels sort of like Soviet issue kind of thing. You know, like one of those toys when my son was little used to have, you know, for army toys, right? You know, it's sort of this uninteresting plastic boxy thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it does have Wi-Fi, which I think is pretty interesting. Unfortunately, the one thing you could do with the Zune with Wi-Fi is you could send a song. They call it squirting. You could squirt a song to someone, you know, with their permission. But that's all messed up because, you know, once you send a song, it's only good for 3 days or three plays, whichever comes first. And, you know, that's even if there's no DRM on the song to begin with. I think that's really awful, and Microsoft let itself be bamboozled by the record labels to agree to these rules. In my book, I talk a lot about how Steve Jobs convinced the record labels to go along with the iTunes Store, and what he really convinced them to do was to make the rules of the digital rights management, the DRM, such that users wouldn't bump into it too often. You know, there would be rules, and some people don't like those, but by and large, people would be able to play the music and do what they do with it and copy it and burn, you know, the songs to discs without running into the restrictions, without hitting the walls. With this Zune squirting idea, you're almost guaranteed to run into the wall. I mean, if someone sends you a song, if you like it, you're going to listen to it maybe more than three times. And if you want to listen to it even for the first time 4 days later, if you're on a trip, no go. Forget it. So, you know, you're guaranteed to get frustrated.
Yeah, it's crazy. Even from what I understand, even if someone were to, for example, send this podcast from one Zune to another, this podcast, which is being issued under a Creative Commons license, would no longer play after 3 days of three plays.
That's right, that's right. Or if you made your own song, you recorded your own song, and you wanted to give it away to everyone, that's tough. You couldn't, you know, send it that way. And, you know, I'm sure that Microsoft would have been perfectly happy to let you do that, but when they went down to the record labels, you know, the record labels, you know, said, well, we'd like you to, you know, this is the only way you'll do this. And instead of really playing hardball with the record labels, which I think they could have done, because the record labels are pretty unhappy that iTunes has such a big market share. That's too much power for Steve Jobs for these guys. So you would think that, you know, they would be a little more willing to, you know, give something up to Microsoft. How about even to say, you know, 3 days or three plays, whichever comes last, might have been better. You know, maybe not all that great, but still better. Nonetheless, you know, these rules are just ridiculous, and I think Microsoft is getting a lot of heat for it.
Yeah, I'm surprised about that. Well, maybe this is a good time to circle back to Sony's attempts to have an MP3 playing device. How come they haven't been able to get anything off the ground?
You know, weirdly, it's this you know, this DRM thing again. That was what really killed the Sony effort. You know, Sony, of course, is a content company. They have a record label. Well, I guess they're partners in a record label with BMG. But at the time, they had their own giant music division, right? Bruce Springsteen, Michael Jackson, all that stuff. And those people who were obsessed with the idea that digital music meant stealing demanded that the electronic side of the company build these incredibly restrictive rules. The first digital Walkman couldn't play MP3s. Imagine that. So, you know, the rules were such that it was basically useless. You know, they satisfied the content people, but it was just a beast to use. And, you know, the thing about digital music is that it is a very fungible medium. You could, you know, use it to move songs around and be free with them. And that, you know, not only turned off that aspect of it, but made the device so hard to use that it was unusable and no one used it.
Yeah. The interesting thing about iPod and iTunes DRM is that I don't think Apple really tried that hard in certain instances about the DRM to protect it. For example, there are a lot of programs that let you copy the songs back off your iPod back onto your computer.
Right, right. Now, every so often, a new version of iTunes might stop those. Apparently, the roadblocks they throw up aren't so formidable that pretty much within a few days, new versions of these other things will come up there. And I agree with you. I don't think Apple is that bothered. The whole idea is not to erect giant walls, but put up speed bumps, really.
Mm-hmm.
The philosophy of Apple in terms of the selling music is that the way they're going to do it is by making it a better experience than getting it free, than going out and getting it free, though it might not be legal. And I think that's the way to go. And part of that is price. That's why Apple, and Steve Jobs has been pretty explicit to me in talking about this. This is why Apple has really insisted on holding the price to 99 cents for a single. I personally feel that the record labels will sell a lot more music if they charge half that or maybe even one-fourth that, and, the actual profits would go up. But nonetheless, charging no more than 99 cents makes sense. And, because Jobs says quite reasonably, boy, if we raise the price now, people would say, oh, the hell with you. We're just going to go out and get it for free, even if it's more of a pain in the neck.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that iTunes could become a label one day and artists could just say, screw dealing with the record labels?
Well, yeah, it wouldn't be necessarily a label, but it could be, a direct distribution medium. I think some places use it now. I mean, mm-hmm. There are a lot of places where, artists don't have major labels. You can make up your own label tomorrow, right? And,
mm-hmm.
I think you could probably, get your songs on iTunes. They've got like 3.5 million songs now. So I think that, the problem is getting yourself heard on that. There still is this, filtering mechanism that the labels do, which make your music look a little more prominent. But I think that we're seeing these rise of these social networking schemes to discover music and music blogs and other things that I think for a lot of artists it's going to start to make sense to go direct. I think probably actually also what's going to happen is in the next few years we're going to see new record labels. I think some smart people from the existing record labels might go and create their own new ones that'll be mostly digital, and they'll understand that their main customers are not going to be places like Tower Records. Actually, this afternoon I just walked through a Tower Records that was going out of business. the digital emporiums like iTunes, and I think that's another thing that's going to start changing the game.
Yeah. How do you think Steve Jobs' role in the creation and development of the iPod differed from his role in the development of the Mac?
Well, I think he was more sort of hands-on, walk around in the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
And the Mac, his job was, the Macintosh days, his job, once he got himself put on the Macintosh project, there's a twisted story behind that, but his role was that the project leader, and he would be a physical presence around there, and he'd walk around. The reviews were much more frequent, if you were working on the Macintosh team, sometimes you would feel literally his hot breath on your neck, and he would be screaming at you how bad something was, and you have to make it better. On the iPod, clearly he's the CEO of a big company, and the iPod was one of many things going on at Apple at the time. Probably not thought of as the most important thing either. He had regular reviews, but he wouldn't kind of go around to where the engineers were, to the guy who was working on the the shuffle function or the integration with some of the middleware or things like that. Basically those people would have reviews with their superiors and the stuff would come to him. He got a little more active towards the end when the interface was being determined. He's very finicky about that.
Mm-hmm.
and I think he had more hands-on to do with that. But otherwise, I mean, he sort of, you know, his job at Apple really is to set the bar. And, you know, I think this is the big thing he does, is he basically says as a baseline, you know, our products have to be innovative, they have to be beautiful, they have to be, you know, easy to use, and, you know, if you don't, if the products that I see, because he does sign off on everything, and he does, you know, comment on things as they go along, he says, if this doesn't come to me and meet those specifications, I'm going to get pretty angry about that, and I'm going to bounce them, and you're going to hear from me. So I think that's the most important thing he does, is he keeps those standards very high.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I liked about the iPod was that it was mainly for, you know, playing audio files, and lately, you know, it's acquired the ability to play video and games, and has started to pick up some kind of PDA attributes like, you know, recording your calendar and address book. Do you think the iPod's in danger of collecting so many bells and whistles that it is no longer as elegant as it once was?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Like when the fifth generation iPod came out, some people, you know, called and still call it the video iPod.
Mm-hmm.
But Apple never called it the video iPod.
Mm-hmm.
It was always, you know, the fifth generation iPod that happened to do video. And even though, you know, it's something they've expanded on the iTunes store, they do movies now. You know, I think Apple gets the music has to be always the soul of the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, it does music a lot better than it does, you know, the TV shows and video. I mean, it's nice to watch on there, but essentially, as a music device, as something, you know, to deliver music and show it in a new way, it's exquisite. You're not going to get a better TV watching experience on an iPod than you are on your home TV, you know, and then you're going to get a big screen TV and watching on a little, you know, a tiny screen is nothing like that. Whereas with music, you get a better experience than you got in your home stereo because you have all the songs with you, you can shuffle them, you get all the advantages of playlists and these other things there. So, I think one encouraging sign was this fall, when they announced movies, it didn't get a lot of attention, but they announced some new features to help you find songs on the iPod, which was very important because now they have an iPod which has 20,000 songs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a search function, and when you scroll around on the wheel, the letter comes up, so you could, you know, see where you are on a list. And, you know, when you, you know, kind of looking for one particular song, it gets tougher to find it the more you have on there. So they're still thinking of the people who mainly use it for music, which is good, I think.
Sure. Which iPod do you use?
Well, I sort of bounce around. I've got my main one, sort of a fifth generation, you know, iPod with the video, and I've got, you know, that's come getting close to 5,000 songs, I guess, on that.
Do you have the 80 megabyte?
Pardon me?
Do you have the 80 meg version?
No,
I mean 80 gig.
For myself, sort of a present for finishing the book. I inscribed it the perfect thing, October 23rd, 2006, which is the publication day, exactly 5 years after the first iPod was announced. And, you know, so I had to send back the, I'm collecting all the Apple loaned iPods I have and sending them back to Apple. I can't keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've got one of those. And then I also got a Nano, which is, you know, like nice to carry around, a little more portable. And, you know, lately I've got little tiny shuffle, which is very cool to have when you're working out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I use a Nano exclusively and love it with the that kind of lanyard thing you wear it around your neck and the headphones come out of the lanyard.
If you have a lot of music, there is just something, and to me, shuffle is just the heart of the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of having a lot of songs that you love and randomizing the whole bunch of them and, you know, not knowing what comes next is really exciting to me. And I also love the idea of being able to feed in songs which, you know, like, you know, the new songs that you might have heard once or twice, and put them in a mix and then have them come up, you know, at unexpected times. It's just very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
It really adds, you know, a level of novelty to the whole experience of listening to music. So there's recently a new program that works with iTunes, We're not affiliated with Apple. It's a product called iLike. Have you heard of that?
No.
So these are the guys who did a service called GarageBand, which is the same name as the Apple Music creation software, but it's actually a web thing where they have unsigned bands offer their music.
Mm-hmm.
And so now they have a sort of a social networking website of people who like music. There's other things like that, already, things like Mog, which is a great social networking site for music. But what they do is they combine it with a GarageBand thing, and there's a little drawer, that opens up when you're playing iTunes, and it tells you, on the top of the drawer, what the similar music is of what you're listening to. So if you're listening to Neil Young, it'll say, there's all similar artists include, like, Buffalo Springfield and Jackson Brown and people like that. But then it tells you, here's some new artists you've never heard of, and you could download free a song from them. So there'll be some, new artist with some similarity to Neil Young in some sense, and you could either listen to a little of the song that person's offering, or you could just download it right away, bang, and start listening. It's yours to keep, and if you're interested, you can go back, of course, and buy stuff from that artist's catalog.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
And it is nice, especially if you decide, you listen to it for a couple seconds, you say, hey, this sounds pretty good, you just throw it into your mix, and then, maybe 2 months later, this will come up on your iPod, you'll say, what the hell is that? If you look at the screen, you can't do this with a shuffle, of course, but if you look at the screen, you'll say, oh, that's that song I downloaded 2 months ago.
That's cool. So that's just ilike.com.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think, the rumored iPhone is going to be like?
Well, I think, it'll be very disappointing if it's just like a phone with an iPod, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like an iPod phone. But I don't think it'll be that. I think, the news, I'm sure it'll play music, but my gut feeling is that Apple will rethink the phone the way they rethought the MP3 player.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's what to look out for is, just to Apple-ize the phone experience. The phone experience is pretty bad.
Yeah.
The phones are computers, but they're closed-up computers. You can't do the fun things you want with the computers. You can't download software all that easily. The whole thing's optimized to make you pay for things that you're used to doing for free on computers, like downloading cool sounds and things like that. Like little things and weird cursors and things like that on your computer. It's shareware or freeware, right?
Mm-hmm.
But on a phone, there's a giant industry based on 30-second ringtone clips.
Mm-hmm.
And I would expect that industry to go away in a few years as phones become more open.
Yeah. Well, I think, Apple's challenge in part was, the same way with iTunes, they had to kind of control the record labels or make these partnerships for the iPhone. They're going to have some kind of arrangement with a carrier or several carriers to get them
right.
to kind of see the light.
That'll be really interesting to see what kind of deal they've, cut. I just heard a rumor, that someone was saying, the guy on Kevin Rose on Big Nation was saying that he heard that Apple cut a deal with all the carriers there. That'll be pretty interesting. To see if they did something like that. Jobs has publicly scolded the carriers for being so closed. He's called them orifices. So it'll be interesting to see, if he's made the orifices open up, so to speak.
All right. Well, I don't have any other questions other than I'm just curious. If you're working on another book, you're always...
I'm not working on one yet. Mm-hmm. I'm going to just take a little time off. It's kind of funny. I just took a walk downtown today and, passed by the offices where I, did a lot of the writing of the book. It was just about mm-hmm. a year ago. I'm still recovering there. The one thing I guess I want to mention here is that, I mentioned how much I like Shuffle, is that I did this experiment with a book where I wrote each chapter about an aspect of the iPod and really wrote each chapter to sort of stand on its own as a separate essay, and then I shuffled the book.
Yeah, that was cool. You your publicist sent me two copies so I could compare the difference. And what are there, like four different versions of the book
out
there?
Yeah, exactly. You know, what we did was I decided the first chapter is always the first chapter, sort of an introduction. But for the other eight chapters, literally we wrote the name on ping pong balls and pulled the ping pong balls out of a basket and came up with a bunch of different shuffles. And then I picked four that, you know, I thought might be the most fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess I didn't want to have the origin chapter last, or the, you know, the couple other things. You know, in one case, I thought maybe one chapter should go before another. But basically, they were all determined randomly, and you know, and I just love the idea that, you know, that your copy might be different than, you know, your friend's copy.
Yeah, that's a cool idea, and the book itself kind of looks like a giant iPod too.
So, yeah, that's right. The biggest iPod, right?
Yeah.
The iPod is like the size of a book, but, you know, it really has that, you know, iPod look to it there.
Yeah, well, I just want to say that I really enjoyed the book. It's a lot of fun, and, you know, just like all the other books you've written, you really get in deep and tell lots of interesting stories that no one else has ever heard before about the history of the iPod. So thanks a lot, Stephen. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
Well, thanks, Mark. And, you know, podcasting about a book about the iPod, what book could be more natural?
That concludes our discussion with Stephen Levy about his latest book, The Perfect Thing, How the iPod Shuffles Commerce, Culture, and Coolness. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, and this is Boing Boing's Get Illuminated. The music for this episode was composed by Gord Fiennes. You can listen to more of his work at gordasm.org.